Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
We're continuing our study in 2 Samuel. Today we're going to be in chapters 8 and 9. Chapter 8 is basically the military conquest of David, and it's kind of outlined this way. Verse 1 is going to be to the east in the Transjordan area, and then verses 3 through 11 is in the north up by Syria. And then verses 13 and 14 is in the south with Edom. And then chapter 9 deals with David's fulfillment of his promise to Jonathan in 1 Samuel chapter 20 about Mephibosheth. And I think it'll be an interesting chapter too. Let's look at the military exploits of David and the way he was expanding his territory is doing two things. It's showing that God was with him in a unique way. This was what the king was to do, is protect Israel from enemies. It's also a seemingly fulfillment of the extension of the promised land to the borders as given to us in back in the Pentateuch. And that's what seems to be in chapter 8. Let's look at it together. Now, after this came about, David, now we're not sure if it's chronological through here and how far this after this refers. Some would say that verses chapters 10 through 12 happened before this, and I'm just not sure. Defeated the Philistines and subdued them, and David took control of the chief city from the hand of the Philistines. Now, the chief city, some wonder about this. In the parallel passage, in 1 Chronicles chapter 18, verse 1, it says Gath and its villages. We're unsure exactly what the Hebrew word means here. Some say it's a place name. Some say it's a stronghold that controlled the area of Gath. But for whatever reason, one of the five major cities of the Philistines fell to David. Now, what that proves is this, that even though they had chariots and could control the flat plains, David's military was superior, and it overcame the Philistines even in the place where their chariots could function. Now, these city-states were along the order of the Greek city-states, because we believe the Philistines were, of course, Aegean people, and that's where they got their governmental structure from. And he defeated Moab. Now, Moab, of course, is one of the tribes on the eastern side of the Jordan. We have Ammon, Moab, and Edom, and all of them are relatives of Abraham. The top two, Ammon and Moab, by the incestuous relationship of Lot with his daughters, and the southern one from Esau, Edom. So this is about Moab. Let's see. We learn from Genesis 19:37 about Lot and how these tribes came to be. And he measured them with a line, making them lie down the ground, and he measured two lines and put to death one full line to keep alive. There was some confusion here in the Greek text. It seems from the Hebrew text that he made three lines and he killed two of them. So it means two-thirds died. From all the ancient versions, it seems he made two lines, not three, and only half of them died. But some would say this is very unusual, David being so vicious to the Moabites. His ancestor Ruth was a Moabitess. Matter of fact, when David was pursued by Saul, he took his parents, Jesse and his mother, and left them in the care of the Moabite king, 1 Samuel chapter 22, verses 3 and 4. The rabbis say in the Mishnah that they killed David's parents, and that's why David retaliated so hard here. We really don't know why, the cause, but he was very severe with Moab. Let's see. Okay, now let's look. By the way, it's interesting that this whole thing about measuring these two lines or three lines out and killing them is not in the parallel of 1 Chronicles 18:2. But you got to remember, 1 Chronicles is written later, and all the negative things about the kings of Judah is removed. So it's not surprising that this was removed from about David's life. Verse 3, and David defeated Hadazar. Now, Hadazar is kind of a form of the word Hadad. And this is a Syrian or Armenian sun god. It was somewhat analogous to the Canaanite Baal, the fertility god. And so here is a Hadad, a man named after the sun god of the Armenians. And you know, it's the king of Zobah. Now, we learn about this from the fact that Saul fought against this same Armenian kingdom to the north in 1 Samuel chapter 14, verse 47. In the news recently, you may have been listening to some of the news about Lebanon, where Syria, modern Syria, has moved into what's called the Bekaa Valley. We think the Bekaa Valley is where this Zorba kingdom of Armenians was at this time. And he went to restore his rule at the river. Now, the he there seems referred to Hadadzer. And the rule at the river, this would be the Euphrates River. It goes by the river. It's the southern of the two rivers of the Promised Land, and the headwaters go up into Syria. Now, this would be the fullest extent of the Promised Land as given to us in Genesis 15, verses 18 through 21, and Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 17, and Deuteronomy chapter 11, verse 24. But he referred to the king. He tried to restore his rule as far as the river and was defeated by David. Now, David captured from him. Now, my New American Standard says 1,700 horsemen. But the word here in Hebrew is 1,000 and then 700 horsemen. Some think it means 1,000 chariots. Because in the parallel account of 1 Chronicles 18:4, it has 1,000 chariots and 7,000 horsemen. And that ratio seems to fit better. So I think the New American Standard has mistranslated this. And I hope you'll compare it with others like the NIV. Okay? Let's see. Alrighty. And 20,000 foot soldiers. And David hamstrung the chariot horses. Now, this hamstrung is interesting. It would be cutting the back tendon on the leg so the horses were crippled and couldn't run. Now, if they couldn't even walk very well. Isn't it funny that David would have all these chariots and then destroy them? It'd be like capturing a bunch of tanks and melting them or something. Why not use those chariots? Well, it's possible that back in Joshua chapter 11, verse 6, where God tells Joshua to destroy the chariots of these northern tribes, that David is just following God's commands to Joshua. Others say he just was so good with his foot soldiers that he didn't use chariots. Now, it says here, my New American Standard says, but he reserved of them 100 chariots. Again, that's not a good translation of the Hebrew, I think. I think David reserved 100 horses to use in probably ferrying notes back and forth. But he did not keep 100 chariots because he didn't use chariots at this point. Now, Solomon will, but David didn't. So I think 100 horses is a much better translation than 100 chariots. And when the Syrians of Damascus came to help, now the reason the Syrians came to help is they were even more southern than the kingdom of Zorbah. They were a little more away from the Mediterranean, but they were trying to stop David's advance to the north. And, of course, look what happens. He just wiped them out and made both of them servant nations. And David put garrisons in Syria of Damascus, and the Syrians became his servants to David, bringing tribute. And the Lord helped David wherever he went. Now, this summary statement about the Lord helped David is very characteristic of this entire book of 2 Samuel. It shows why David was so successful. You might want to see chapter 3, verse 18. You might want to see chapter 5, verses 10 and 12, chapter 7, verse 9, and here in chapter 8, verse 14, the same kind of theological tag is placed on David's victories. Now look at verse 7. And David took the shields of gold, which were carried by the servants of Hadadezer. Now, these shields of gold are somewhat controversial. The Syriac word means quivers, so it'd be arrows overlaid with gold. But the Septuagint calls them bracelets. So I'm not sure if it's shields covered with gold or quivers or what. The word's kind of ambiguous, but it was something that was precious metal was attached to it and was carried by the bodyguard, the royal bodyguard of the king of Zorbah, and they were captured and brought to Jerusalem. Now, in verse 8, there are two cities mentioned, but in the parallel of 1 Chronicles, there are two different cities mentioned in the same place. We're not sure where these are, but the locality is one that's known for its copper mining. Matter of fact, it said, and King David took a large amount of bronze. Now, it's interesting that in the parallel, in 1 Chronicles 18:8, it mentions that later on Solomon used this very bronze to build some of the things in his temple, like the bronze laver and the bronze pillars. Matter of fact, the Septuagint and the Vulgate include that little phrase about Solomon using this right here in this passage. And some have think maybe a Hebrew phrase has dropped out. It's interesting to me to know that down in verse 11, it mentions about David dedicating these precious metals to the Lord. And that's why I think Solomon used them. I think David was gathering all of this material to build the temple when Solomon came to be king. And now another group is mentioned in verse 9. Now it came that Toi, king of Hamath. Now Hamath is a kingdom north of Zorbah. It's on the Orontes River. He was glad that David had defeated the country to the south of him. And so he sent his son. Now look in verse 10. Toi sent. Now I have Joram in my New American Standard Version in verse 10. But if you look at the parallel of 1 Chronicles 18:10, he's called Hadoram. Again, this name Hadad. I think what's happened is that his original name was Hadad, but that David may have changed his name to a name that used the word Yahweh. Joram has the word Yahweh in it. I doubt this northern kingdom who worshipped Hadad would have a royal son named after Yahweh. So it sounds like something David probably did later on and gave him a throne name after he became a tribute, a nation to David. Now look at, verse 12 and verse 13. This is my New American Standard. From the Syrians and Moab and the sons of Ammon and the Philistines and Amalek and from the spoils of Hadadezer, and look at verse 13. And he made a name for himself when he returned from killing 18,000 Syrians in the Valley of Salt. Now, friends, if you look, usually Syria is not connected with Moab and Ammon. Who is usually connected with Moab and Ammon? Edom. Edom is one of the three Transjordan tribes. Matter of fact, the Valley of Salt is probably the Arabah just south of the Dead Sea. That's much too far south for Syria. Probably there's been a mistranslation of the Hebrew text here. The word for a ram and the word for Edom are only different by one consonant in Hebrew. And it's obvious this is Edom. Matter of fact, the Revised Standard Version of the Bible puts Edom in verse 12 and verse 13, and I think rightly so. Now, the sons of Ammon in verse 12, that's what's going to be discussed in 2 Samuel chapters 10 through 12 that we'll cover next time. And so you see, we're out somewhat of chronological order. Now, Amalek, that's dealt with back in 1 Samuel chapter 30. If there's another campaign against the Amalekites, the traditional enemy of Israel, we know nothing about it. And this is the only reference we have. Now, you can see that David is putting garrisons in all these countries. Now, in verse 15, and David reigned over all Israel, and David administered justice and righteousness for all the people. He's a godly king. He's acting in the place of a godly king, and that's why these words justice and righteousness are used. Matter of fact, they're used in Psalms 99, verse 4, to describe the reign of the godly king. This shows that David was doing what God wanted him to do, is being an earthly representative of God's kingship. He was fair, he was just, he was righteous to all his people. And I think that's very important because other groups besides just Israel is being incorporated into David's kingdom. The kingdom is coming much wider than just the 12 tribes. And Joab, now remember back in 1 Chronicles chapter 11, verse 10, we learned that Joab is the military commander. And the reason for that was David said earlier, we looked at it, the first one to get inside Jebus, I'll make him my military commander. We learned from 1 Chronicles 11:6 that Joab, his relative, was the first one to go through the water channel, whatever that means, and to help attack the city of Jebus, and he became the military commander of David, and he's mentioned here. So verses 15 through 18 show us some of the early levels of administration, the areas of David's government that we know something about, but not very much. There was the military commander, that's Joab. And then we have Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, as recorder. But this word recorder is interesting. Some say it refers to an office of keeping the records about the king. It's mentioned several times in the Old Testament. 2 Kings chapter 18, verse 18 and 37. 2 Chronicles 34, verse 8. Isaiah 36, verses 3, 11, and 22. We're not exactly what they recorded, but I'm sure they may have recorded something like the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel, the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah, those kinds of records. Then it has Zadok, son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar. Now, obviously, this is the first mention of Zadok here. His genealogy is given in 1 Chronicles 6, 3 through 8. Some scholars assume that he is really not a Levite, but may be the high priest of Jebus. That David overcame, going back to Melchizedek, because the name Zadok is in a few kings of Salem. I think that's somewhat ambiguous, and I prefer to accept the chronology and the genealogy of 1 Chronicles about Zadok. Zadok is going to be one of the chief priests during the time of David. Now, it looks like that Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar. Now, that is very surprising. Because always it's Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech. It looks like that by accident a scribe has reversed the order of these names. It's always Zadok and Abiathar that are linked together throughout David's reign. Both the chronicle parallel and this place here have the two names transposed, apparently. I think there's been a problem in the Hebrew text being copied by scribes. If you want to see where Zadok and Abiathar are usually listed together, you might want to see 1 Samuel 22:20, 2 Samuel 15, verse 24 and 29. Okay? Now, notice if you would where it says, and there was a secretary, Zerah. Some have supposed this man goes by several names in the different parallels, and some say one of the names is very close to an Egyptian name for a particular officer at court. That may be true. David may have ordered his kingdom somewhat on an Egyptian line, but we just can't be sure of that. Now we have two of the man here in verse 18 mentioned as a commander over the Cherethites and the Pelethites. Now, this man is also mentioned in 1 Kings 2:35 as being made captain of the armies by Solomon. And apparently he was the controller or the captain of this royal bodyguard of David. Now, it seems that the Cherethites, they're identified with Judah in 1 Samuel 30:14. Many believe they were a mercenary group of Cretans. They think the name means Cretans, or a GNC people like the Philistines that were part of David's original military group. And some say that the word Pelethites is kind of corruption of the word Philistines, and that some of David's original army folks were Philistines. And that seems to be true, though we can't be a dogmatic. Now, these two groups are called his personal guard in chapter 23, verses 22 and 23 of 2 Chronicles, and you might want to look at that. And David's sons were chief ministers. Now, that is very interesting here, because the word here is Cohen, and the word Cohen means priest. But how could David's sons be priests? They were not from the tribe of Levi. Some say, well, this is further evidence that they were priests, kind of like the sons of the priest of Jebus. And they say this to show that Zadok was the priest of Zebus, and that David's sons became priests after him, because by capturing the city, David became the priest king of Salem, later changed to Jerusalem. Now, I think that's pure speculation. To me, the word Cohen, we have lost the meaning of this word. The etymology is uncertain. We're not sure what it means. But in other parallel passages, particularly 1 Chronicles 18:17, this word is used in the sense of court officials. And that makes much more sense from the context that David's sons were court officials and not priests. So I would prefer that interpretation. Now let's go to chapter 9 that deals with David's kindness to Mephibosheth. And then David said, "Is there yet anyone left in the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Now this kindness is a very important Hebrew word. It's the Hebrew word hesed that means covenant love, covenant loyalty. We understand this kind of loyalty going back to David's love and covenant with Jonathan. I think that the most important passage is 1 Samuel chapter 20, particularly verses 15 and 42. Also, 1 Samuel 24:21 and 2 Samuel 21:7 is an allusion to this famous covenant brought about by Jonathan and David, to which David is trying to be faithful years after Jonathan's death. Some say this was for political reasons, to keep an eye on Mephibosheth, but I really think the tone of this is not political reasons, not behind the throne maneuvering of David. I think it's David's attempt to be faithful to his covenant with his friend. Some say, why did he wait so long? As some would say, it's possibly years after this. Well, I think David had spent many years in battles with these neighbors, and when he finally got a time of rest or a respite from this fighting is when he decides to do this. Now, there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba. Now, apparently he was a foreman of the lands, okay, of Benjamin. And they called him to David, and the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "I am your servant." And the king said, "Is there not yet any one of the house of Saul whom I may show the kindness of God?" Here again, the word hesed. And Ziba said to the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan who is crippled in both feet." Now, as you know, back when there was an attempt to kill all of Saul's children, one of the nurses grabbed this young boy and ran with him, and we're in 2 Samuel 4:4, dropped this baby, and it crippled his feet. Now, being crippled in feet meant that this boy really couldn't be king of Israel. There was kind of an aversion to someone being crippled and being king. You might want to compare 1 Kings 15:23, and some would say yes, but he was going to try to be king anyway from 2 Samuel 16:3. I don't think Mephibosheth had any desires to do that, although there probably were still some who wanted Saul's family to rule, but I don't think Mephibosheth was part of that group. So the king said to him, "Where is he?" And Ziba said to the king, "Behold, he's in the house of Machir, the son of Ammiel in Lodabar." Now this man becomes very significant later on. This is apparently a location in the Gilead area, in the Transjordan area. It was close to Ish-bosheth's capital. This apparently was a wealthy man, a friend of Saul's family, who took care of Jonathan's son. From 1 Chronicles chapter 3, verse 5, some say this was the father of Bathsheba. But from the parallel, in chapter 11, verse 3, it has a different name for this man, and so I don't really think it is Bathsheba's father. Later in David's life, when David has to flee from his own son's rebellion, chapter 17, verse 27, this man will be very helpful to David as he has to flee Jerusalem. And so I think a friendship is made here that will last. We don't know where Lodabar is, except that it's probably somewhere in Gilead, close to Ish-bosheth's capital. And David sent for him. I'm sure that Mephibosheth thought he was going to put him to death, because that was what would be expected, but he didn't. Now, the word Mephibosheth is interesting. We learn that his name really is Meribaal from 1 Chronicles chapter 8, verse 34, and 1 Chronicles 9, verse... I can't read my writing. I think it's verse 40. But what the Jews did is change the name Baal to Bosheth. And Baal was the fertility god, and Bosheth in Hebrew means shame. So it was their way of kind of throwing aspersions on somebody who had Baal in their name. Kind of like I think that David changed the name of Hadaram to Joram. They were offended by these foreign gods in people's names. And so his name became Mephibosheth. And there's a kind of a play here on the meaning. There are several different proposed meanings of Mephibosheth. I'm not sure exactly which one is best. So he called him there, and he fell down before him, prostrated himself in verse 8, and said, "Why should you regard a dead dog like me?" It's obvious from other places where the word dog is used. Example, David refers to himself as a dog when Saul is chasing him in 1 Samuel 24:14, that this was a term of derision, a term of humility. Now, little dogs weren't little poodles with bows in their hair and colored toenails. They were scavengers. They were mongrels. They were not kept as pets at all. So to call yourself a dog was a way of referring to yourself in shame and derision. And so Mephibosheth, why should you care about me? And in verse 9, the king explains to him about the why. Now, the word son is used in verse 9, but it's really grandson that's meant. Now, of course, you have to realize that the Hebrew term son, all of these relative terms in Hebrew are very fluid and can refer to a large group of people. They're just not precise terms. So grandson and son are both appropriate translations. Now, Ziba is going to be commanded to give back all the lands. Apparently, he was gaining the revenue from them before this. David gave all those lands to Mephibosheth, and Ziba was to work them for him, and all the revenue was to go to Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth was to eat at David's table, and that was David's sign of fulfilling his covenant to Jonathan. It was a great honor for these people to eat at David's table, to eat at David's expense, and so it's a way of honoring Mephibosheth. Some scholars say he was just trying to keep his eye on Mephibosheth. Again, I think the political intrigue is read into this chapter and is not obviously here. I've heard some sermons built on this that say this is a symbol of grace and the crippled feet are a symbol of sin and David's table a symbol of grace. I think that's all allegory, and I totally reject that as even a possible interpretation. You must interpret the Bible along the lines of the original author's intent. That is all that is inspired, and the author of Samuel meant to say nothing like that. That's pure Alexandrian spiritualizing. Yuck, yuck, yuck. Now, notice, if you would, he has a son named Micah. And we learn about this. We learn of the genealogy from Micah's genealogy from 1 Chronicles 8, verse 34 and following, and 1 Chronicles 9, verse 40 through 44. Now, he was a possible rival to the throne, but it simply did not work out that way. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, and he ate at the king's table regularly, and he was lame in both feet. Later, he will be accused of treason in 2 Samuel 16, 1 through 4, and he's going to be betrayed by Ziba in 2 Samuel 19, verse 24 through 30. I'm not sure how much of this was not jealousy on Ziba's part for the land being taken away and given to this grandson of Saul. It's hard to read a psychological interpretation of some of these passages, and so we're not exactly sure what is fiction and what is the truth in this particular account. Kind of like Saul's death. Did Saul kill himself, or did the Amalekite kill him? Well, I think the Amalekite story is a lie, and Saul really killed himself. Same thing is true about Mephibosheth's rebellion and Ziba's saying he betrayed him. Well, this is the end of this particular lesson. We have here a summary statement of the borders of Israel being expanded to their penitential boundaries. We have the God being with David militarily and bringing him peace, showing he was with him. And throughout this passage, God is shown as the real warrior, the real power, the real giver of military victory and peace. It's God fulfilling his promise to David that we find in 2 Samuel chapter 7, but it's really God fulfilling his promise to Abraham that we find back in Genesis chapter 12. And again, we see David's his spirituality. He attributes this to God. His reign is of righteousness and justice. He has a compassionate heart about his covenant that he made in God's name with Jonathan and tries to fulfill that to his son Mephibosheth. All of these, I think, are spiritual qualities of David that we see in his life. And he'll set the example for the type of the Messiah to come. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.